Well, you can't talk CSI without having some who. We've in this series looked at who are you, we've looked at don't get fooled again, and today we're looking at a front. The claim against Christianity goes like this. We can't trust the biographies of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because they weren't even written by eyewitnesses in the first century. That's the argument. And so is there any proof that that's true? Is it all just a front, all just a lie, all just an opiate for the masses? Or is what's claimed in the Bible historically accurate? That's what we've been looking at together in our series, Cold Case Detective. With that, we followed the personal journey of a real cold case detective. His name is Jim Wallace. He comes from a three-generation detective family, all claimed to be atheists. And as they began to see his wife, Jim, get serious about faith, he began to investigate, like a cold case detective, whether or not she was getting into a cult. Is this stuff really true? And so in this series, we've been looking at his methodology for seeing if the Bible's true from a detective perspective, but also we've been opening up cold cases. He's had more of his cold cases used in Dateline than anyone else. And so we've been opening his cases and seeing how he solved cases and those principles we're going to use applied to history in the Bible. Let me give you one more case today that we're going to look at. This is a particularly unusual one when it comes to eyewitness reliability. The case is a sad one. Terry Hollis was killed. She was a quiet kid from California, and the crowd and the community was just in shock that this had happened. They're trying to find who did it. Jim Wallace's father did the original investigation when it opened in 1972. He will reopen the case in 1992. Jim Wallace's dad was a seasoned homicide detective. He's sitting across the table from a man who confesses to the murder. And as he's taking notes in this investigation, the man seems all too eager to confess to the murder. In fact, though it initially looks pretty authentic, there's tears. He talks of being unburdened by guilt and a guilty conscience. His eyes would light up when he talked about the details of the story. In fact, by the time Jim Wallace's father finished investigating this, this man had 1,000 pages of testimony on what happened when he did it and admitted to how he did it. There's something in his gut instinct and the test for an eyewitness he used that says, I don't think this guy, though he's confessing to doing it, really did it. So he left the case open. And his son, Jim Wallace, who you'll see in just a second, picks up the case and solves it 20 years later. How did he deduce that this guy was not an actual eyewitness to the murder he was confessing to? Well, in this next clip you're going to see, as he journeyed through the facts, he began to believe the Bible was historically reliable and Jesus is who he says he was in these historic documents. And the claim that it's all just a front, these eyewitnesses didn't even live during the time period of Jesus, he begins to explain this next clip how using detective skills he determined that these were written by eyewitnesses, by disciples in the first century. Let's watch this clip and we'll dive in.
So I think that there's lots of good reason in the missing data in the New Testament that certain events have not occurred yet. And that means that this is written before those missing events. There's the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem occurs in 70 AD. There's no description of it anywhere in Scripture, even though Jesus allegedly predicts it. Why not include it? You'll show your reader that he's an accurate predictor. Nope, not included. The death of Peter, not mentioned. The death of Paul, not mentioned. The death of James, the brother of Jesus, not mentioned in the book of Acts. The death of Barnabas, not mentioned. Even though Luke is careful to mention the death of James, the brother of John, who died in 44, a nobody. Who cares about James, the brother of John? James, the brother of Jesus, led the largest church on the planet at the time. Yet you're not going to mention how he dies? Why not? Well, because it hasn't happened yet. And if you trace these things back, you're going to find yourself dating the book of Acts in the 50s, and you're already within the lifetime of eyewitnesses, and we know that he wrote Luke's gospel, he wrote before the book of Acts, so now you got an earlier date for that. You know he quotes more Mark than anybody else in Scripture, so now you've got Mark written before Luke. Now, when it comes to corroboration, let's put it this way. There's tons of archaeology, there's internal corroboration, the way that the writers use certain pronouns that are only known in the region. The fact that they know the robust collection of cities, including nowhere towns that nobody would know if you're writing from Egypt, for example, or writing in a different epic period of time. There's lots of corroboration. I wrote about this in a book called Cold Case Christianity, Inside and Out. When you mention real locations, you'd at least have to say that those locations are part of your corroboration set. Just be honest. Let's be fair. So I think it was what helped me check the second box. The third box for me is, has it changed over the years? And if you look at the heel-to-toe statements of the eyewitnesses like John and his students, what did John tell you? Ignatius, Polycarp, Papias, and then their students, Irenaeus, and then his student, Hippolytus. And you keep on tracing the claims that are written in manuscripts of how Jesus is described. Here's what you're going to discover. There is no manuscript evidence to support that the story of Jesus is evolving. The born of a virgin, miracle working, rising from the dead Jesus has always been there from the very beginning on every ancient manuscript of teacher to student going through history. If you're following Paul's students, John's students, Peter's student, Mark, whoever you're following, you're not going to see that story evolve. And then finally, it's about bias. And I don't think there's only three reasons why anyone lies. It's financial greed, sexual lust, and the pursuit of power. That last one, that pursuit of power one, is the huge umbrella that catches almost everything. But just know that those are the ways we assess eyewitnesses to see, are they lying or do they have anything to gain? Well, what are these apostles gaining here? They're not getting rich. They're not getting girlfriends. And they're not getting powerful, because it turns out all of them were executed for their claims. And people like Paul were already powerful, yet they abandoned their position of power within Judaism, a much bigger group that was safer to live in, to join a group in which he's going to get beaten up for the next 30 years and ultimately get martyred. So I think in the end, this claim that, is it possible? Are any of those things possible? Yes. Are they reasonable? No. And that's why I thought the most reasonable inference is that I should trust these as four historical documents that, unlike the objection, ought to be included in the historical record of the first century.
So the first century, I mean, how does an atheist become a follower of Jesus by following that evidence? Well, in our series, we've looked at becoming detective combers, and we've looked at these multiple steps. How do we use circumstantial evidence accurately with the preponderance of evidence? We talked about being open-minded despite how we grew up to the facts, looking for backing for the claims, and today we're going to tackle eyewitness reliability. Do we know that it's true? For many of us, maybe we've been turned off by Christianity, not because of its claims, but because of the way Christians behave. You're like, you talk about a front. They can be judgmental. They can be hypocritical. And you're like, listen, even if you're right, I don't want to live the way you live. And that can be a real turnoff. Other people, you know, you began to investigate, you run into a Christian, and they say, hey, I want you to trust God to be your king, both now and forevermore. Okay, could I ask some questions first? No questions. You just got to have faith. Faith doesn't question. Well, wait a second. I don't make that decision any other way in my life. I ask questions before I make a decision. And you're telling me God wants to be my father. That sounds pretty good, but I want to know what kind of father. What does that mean? You're telling me he wants to be a king that reigns over me, with a kingdom that reigns over me, with a love that reigns over me. I want to ask some serious questions. And the idea you hear from our culture is that faith is the absence of evidence. Was that true? Is faith trusting without verifying? Or is faith verifying and then trusting? I want to propose to you that, like any other area of your life, faith is about verifying what's true before you trust. That's the act of stepping onto it. And if you weren't encouraged to doubt, to question, to investigate, I would just say Horizon's a place you can explore. Verify what's true, and then step out and trust in it. That's what we're going to look at today. We're going to look at four questions that a detective uses. We're going to use the word case. C, is their story consistent? A, do they have an agenda, the eyewitnesses? S, were they really spectators, and can they tell us stuff only spectators could tell us? And E, is there any evidence of what they've said is true? I remember many years ago, I went to lunch with a buddy who is kind of a on-air personality here in town, so I won't tell you who it is, because he kind of keeps his atheism to himself. And so we're chatting over lunch, and he had just seen a debate between a Christian speaker and Bill Nye, and I happened to be there at that debate. And he says, you know, I really enjoyed the debate because it was civil, It was respectful. He said, but I think what I really almost respect about you Christians is your ability to completely believe things that aren't true with no evidence. And you know, he was actually being sincere, but I was like, that's not what I believe at all. I felt like saying, I really appreciate what an imbecile you are, is what I pretty much heard him say. I said, that's actually not our position. Our position is that the evidence does back up the claims and that we do have the facts on our side. He's like, you think that? I said, yeah. And we just had this really robust discussion. So I want to lay on some of the facts about that I had that day with him, and maybe that would be helpful in your journey as well. Number one, the C, consistency. Are you telling the same story over time? So here's one of our eyewitnesses, John, writes this biography, and he's going to cite in his biography that the story of these facts has been going on for 1,000 years. Let me read it to you. You hear this kind of around Easter time. It's about Jesus' death. One of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. Now, if you remember from earlier this year, we did a series called Brains of the Operation. I investigated and interviewed multiple surgeons and doctors, and I asked them about this. Is it possible that you can stab somebody with a spear and something that looks like blood and water comes out? And they gave me all the science behind why that was true. Well, if a guy makes that up in the first century before modern medicine, how does he come up with that unless it really happened? And he who has seen has testified. So John's saying, I really saw this. Not I believe this, I saw it, I've seen this, I'm testifying, and my testimony is true. And he's talking about himself, knows that he is telling the truth, so that you may believe. He wants you to believe this because he was there, he claims. For these things were done that the scripture should be fulfilled. In other words, what I'm saying happened has been predicted hundreds of years over time. Then he quotes this, not one of his bones shall be broken. That's a quote from a manuscript from 1000 BC by King David, who says Messiah is going to come one day and they're not going to break his bones. This is very unusual. Whenever the Romans crucified somebody, they always broke your bones because the way you die by crucifixion is you can't push yourself up in your legs anymore to breathe. So they break your bones, so you basically suffocate to death. Everyone had their bones broken. But uniquely, just like was predicted 1000 BC, they don't break Jesus' bones. He then says, also, we have another scripture over time that predicted that the Messiah, they will look on him whom they pierced. We're actually studying that book in our equipping service right now at 8:30 and 9:45 from the book of Zechariah. 500 BC, it's predicted that Messiah will come and he will die by piercing, not by hanging, not by drowning, not by poisoning, by piercing. So it's saying, I saw what happened and it's consistent with what we've been predicting all through time. Well, many years ago, maybe about 15 years ago, I saw a book by David Limbaugh. Don't know who he was. I'd heard of his brother Rush, I guess, on radio. But I noticed that he stopped writing political books. He had a lot of pretty venomous political books. And he wrote this book called Jesus on Trial. And then his next six books were all about Jesus. I'm like, either he needs a new market or something's happened. So I put in a call, and he actually took my phone call. And I said, hey, I was reading your book. I understand you're an attorney. He says, yeah, I'm an attorney. He said, I met a group of guys who are Christian business people. They invited me to this mayor's luncheon, and I started a Bible study with this group called CBMC. And as I was going through it, I began to, for the first time in my life, read the actual accounts, not what I heard somebody say of what they heard. I said, one thing I noticed about your book is how much you cut and paste directly from the Bible. People don't usually do that in a book because it's like one little verse and let me tell you how important things I have to say. He said, the reason I put so much scripture in my book is because that's what convinced me. Reading the actual evidence and the actual exhibits from the biographers convinced me. He said, so that's where I wrote my first book called Jesus on Trial. It was about my journey as a lawyer looking at the facts and letting other people see the same facts. I thought, that's really fascinating. And it became really a passion point for him to help other people see what he had seen. Because consistency, that story over time, was the same. Which moves us to A, the agenda. Well, do these biographers, John and others, do they have an agenda? Are they going to get rich over this? Are they going to get lustful women over this? Are they going to get powerful over this? Well, let's give another claim by John. Here's what he says. When Pilate, a very powerful Roman citizen there and representative, heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and set him down in the judgment seat. So John's telling us this guy named Pilate. He sits in something called the judgment seat in a place called the pavement, which is a big flat stone area in Jerusalem. But in Hebrew, it's called Gabbatha. And it was preparation day of the Passover and about the sixth hour. Do you see already, this doesn't sound like a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. There was Puff the Magic Dragon. I mean, he's given us dates, people, times, and places. This is something we can check out. And it was preparation day of the Passover, about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, Pilate did, "Behold your king!" And they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priest says, "We have no king but Caesar." All of a sudden, they're big fans of the Roman government who's occupied them because they don't like Jesus. So we see him claiming that all these different details and people rejected the very Messiah that God had predicted. All right, is that true? How would you even know? And did John have an agenda for writing this? Does Paul, one of the early leaders, have an agenda for writing this? When Jesus' brother becomes a follower and leader of the early church, as he mentioned, how did that end for him? Did he become a powerful pope or something? Well, we have Roman, we have Jewish, and we have Christian historians all testifying to how brutally these guys were killed. Let's start with a Roman historian. This guy named Tacitus, he writes in history. Here's what he says happened to the people who wrote this stuff. "Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians, by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty." He got crucified. "During the reign of Tiberius, at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate." Oh, that's exactly what our eyewitness said. Oh. "And a most mischievous superstition," they thought he raised Ray from the dead, "thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome." So we have a Roman historian saying these guys got killed for it and validating a lot of the details here. All right, let's move to another Roman. This one is a Roman slash Jewish historian named Josephus. He's writing about another one of the disciples who gets killed. This is Jesus' brother, James. "He assembled the Sanhedrin," big fancy group of religious leaders, "and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others, and delivered them to be stoned." So we have another eyewitness. He wrote a book of the Bible called the Book of James. And he gets killed and stoned. Stone's thrown at you, not stoned, got stoned. Because of this claim he made. Now this next guy, Clement of Rome, this is the earliest manuscript we have that's not those four Gospels. So this guy's written the earliest manuscript we have of any letter outside of the Bible. And he records, "Peter," another one of the disciples, wrote two books of the Bible, "suffered martyrdom, departed to the place of glory due to him, owing to envy." Paul also, another early church, wrote half the book of the New Testament, "suffered martyrdom under the prefects." So we have all these different historic pieces saying, listen, if these guys had an agenda, it didn't work out real well. They got obliterated. They just got smacked around really badly. So let me tell you two stories that I know about. So I got a chance to travel to Turkey many, many years ago, maybe about 10 years ago. And while I was in Turkey, I got to see where one of his disciples, Philip, died. There's a mosaic of Philip. He comes to Turkey. So here's his disciple. He travels all the way, just like Jesus said, go into all the world. He travels all the way from the Middle East all the way up to Turkey. And here in this area we visited, we got to see the very place that he got stoned with the stories of what happened there. And I'm like, I'm standing right there like, this is where one of Jesus' actual disciples was right here and died because of what he believed. Not powerfully. Doesn't even get a statue there. That's not a statue of him. It's like a statue of Zeus. But this is the place, with no agenda, with no benefits to his message, he came to tell about God's forgiveness and God's love. So then I was in Greece in April. We're going to do a whole series about my trip to Greece in April, next January. And while I was there, I got to go to this church, which is built on top of a crypt. And the crypt is a place where a guy named Demetrius was. So it's about 200 AD. Christianity is outlawed by the Roman Empire. You get killed for doing this. And one of the Roman soldiers becomes a Christian. And he decides to keep telling people he's a Christian. Well, is that going to go well? It doesn't go well. They tell him to shut up. He refuses to. This Roman soldier who doesn't take much from anybody, says, you can't tell me what to do. I'll fight your wars for you, but I'm going to tell you about Jesus. He keeps preaching on it, so the Romans finally tell other Roman soldiers to kill him. They beat him up in the streets. Well, some of the followers of Jesus take Demetrius, and they drag his body back to this cave. And that cave becomes this underground crypt. And for years, next 500 years in Greece, they begin to have an underground baptism and church there because of this guy. Years later, after Christianity wasn't outlawed, they built this giant church on top of it. But I'm going down there like Indiana Jones. I'm down in this crypt, and I'm like, here's a guy at 200 AD against all the force of the Roman Empire continued to say, I believe and know the people who believed and saw that Jesus was alive. Wow. What agenda would promote you to do that? Well, maybe getting to heaven. Well, there's a lot of ways in religions to get you to heaven. Why would you claim that a guy came back from the dead when your whole life was threatened by it? So that's our A, agenda. Next is, were they really spectators? And do they know things that only spectators would know? There's certain things that if you lived in the first century, if you were there when Jesus died, you would know certain things that other people wouldn't. And what did John say earlier, right? He says, I saw it, my testimony is true, and I'm telling you the truth that you might believe. Okay, spectator, were you really there? What can this person show me that shows they had presence and access to things only someone living in that place at that time would know? Well, let's go back to that earlier passage he had, right? What did he say? Well, he said Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Were they really crucifying during that time? When they took Jesus and led him away, he's bearing a cross, they went to a place called the place of the skull, which in Hebrew is called Golgotha. Does that place even exist? Have we ever found that place? Where they crucified him with two others, one on one side, one on the other, and Pilate, did Pilate really exist? He wrote a title and put it on the cross, and this was Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Now, for a lot of years, people mocked Christianity. When I say a lot, I mean like 1,000 years. People are like, there's no such person as Pilate. They made it up like Darth Vader. I took your Messiah and I put him on a cross. It's this made up bad guy. There was no evidence of it. And so all the biographies were mocked for their claim that there was a guy named Pilate who crucified Jesus, or him crucified. Well, there's so much evidence. I'll just give you 3 pieces today. We have found feet bone with the nail still going through that, of how they would crucify. They would put your hands here, pound it through your wrist, put through your hand, it would just rip through. They put through the 2 bones right where your nerve is. Imagine that's what the Romans did. And then they would take your feet, put them together, and pound a nail through it, exactly as described in the 4 biographies. Well, sure enough, we now have stone evidence of people whose feet were put together, petrified, with the giant stake going right through it, exactly as someone described who's living in that century. You might say, well, the Romans continued that for 100 years. It could have been 100 years later. Okay, maybe. But Pilate, for 1,000+ years, people said the Bible had made up Pilate. Until the 1940s, in a place called Caesarea Maritime, it's like a little harbor city in Israel, they dug up and they found a stone with Pilate's name. So that's it right there. It's in Latin. That's Pilate Tiberius, of Tiberius Pilate. But it also mentions, as I zoomed into the details, his specific title, the prefect of Judea. The exact title, in detail, of what he was called by those 4 biographers. It's one thing to get his name right. It's one thing to get his title right, but a long title, it was very unusual, was cited by them in the Gospels, showing these guys were spectators. They were there. Only somebody who lived in that place in that town would get the name right, and the archaeology backs it up, as well as the actual details of it. Besides that, they found that Pilate has 2 different offices, one here in Jerusalem in this model that they rebuilt, and the other one in this harbor city I got a chance to visit where they found this. They later found out there was lots of evidence of Pilate's. Besides a Jewish historian named Josephus, they also found coins that had Pilate's name on it. Now, each one of these things doesn't stand on its own, but all of it begins to build a case that these are things that only someone in the first century would know, would cite, would describe, that would be accurate, which builds the case that this is true. Now, if you ever follow many podcasts, I watch Bill Maher, one of my many ones, and Bill Maher is a pretty famous atheist and political commentator, and calls himself an old school liberal. And he was interviewing Alan Richson, And if you don't know Alan, he plays Reacher on TV. You know, any Reacher fans, but Reacher is this army cop who just gets in trouble and beats up bad guys. So if you like that kind of stuff, I like that kind of stuff. Alan plays that. But Alan's a Christian. And so Alan goes on a podcast with Bill Maher. And Bill asks him about his faith. They have a pretty good discussion. And Bill says, well, okay, I'm fine if you want to be a Christian. Just don't impose it on me. And surely you got to know that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John weren't written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They were written by people hundreds of years later, and they made up the whole story, and the whole thing's a mockery. I mean, you know that, right? Alan's like, well, I'd never really looked into this. Alan's like, well, I don't know. I just believe it. And Bill's like, I'm good with that. As long as you know what you're believing is a lie. And I think what happens is you hear confident people like Bill Maher say these very strongly worded things, and he's a smart guy, says smart things. And who's got time? You're building a business, you're doing this. Who's got time to look into this? But the chain of custody does not support what Bill says. The chain of custody and all the evidence we're showing shows these were actual witnesses in the first century who lived with Jesus, not somebody later. We have plenty of those. They're called Gnostic Gospels that came hundreds of years later, we can cite. Now, the facts don't back that up. And that's where we get to the last pace of our case, which is they're not just spectators, is there evidence? Is the information corroborated that they really were eyewitnesses in the first century who saw what they said they saw? So I want to give you one example. There's a book called Hidden in Plain Sight. And it's a really fascinating book. It's a scholar by the name of Lydia McGrew. And she shows how when you set these biographies next to each other, there's all these hidden coincidences that show that this is a cohesive story that was true. So she's got many examples in the book. I want to give you one. It's going to take me a minute or two to develop it, but I think it'll make sense. One biographer is describing the time Jesus fed 5,000 people. Here's what he says, John. Now the Passover, that's a big feast the Jews celebrate God's forgiveness and deliverance from slavery. So during that time of the year, Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Jesus lifted up his eyes, seeing a great multitude, 5,000 people plus coming toward him, he turns to Philip, one of his disciples, and says, hey, where should we buy bread that these may eat? Now, you kind of just go on with the story, but you're like, I wonder why he asked Philip. Why doesn't he ask Peter? Why doesn't he ask John? Why does he ask Philip? You don't know, and in one sense, it doesn't matter. However, then you read another biographer who gives you another piece of the puzzle. Then he took them and went aside privately into a deserted place belonging to the city called Bethsaida. Okay, so he tells us it's at Passover, but it's a specific place near Bethsaida where he's going to feed the 5,000. Okay, a little detail, but what's the big deal? Doesn't matter. John gives us another detail about the same story. He says, oh, by the way, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. You're like, oh, well, of course, and that makes sense in the first one. If you're going to Bethsaida and you're trying to find where to get food, you would talk to the guy who's from Bethsaida. All right, only people, it's not like you coordinated to get this story, but only if something was true would all these pieces fit. I'll give you one more. Another biography named Mark writes, same story, and says, then he commanded them, the 5,000 people, to sit down in groups on green grass, to which we're like, who cares? Well, because you haven't been to Israel. It's never green grass. It's always dead, dry grass. There's only green grass during one or two times a year when it rains. You know what time it rains a whole lot in Israel? During the time of the Passover. It's one of the few rainy times in Israel. You start going, oh, it's not like they coordinated to do this. You got these little details, and when you put them together, oh, that actually does all fit together. And she starts giving example after example of all these things. It's not a made-up story, but people who would be telling the truth, living the same time period, all their accounts should fit together as they do in this one instance of many. But Jesus makes a pretty stunning claim. He not only claims that he's the king sent from heaven, he not only claims that he can forgive you and has an administration or a kingdom for your life, but he predicts his own death. Sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. Often he does it through stories. One time he predicts his death using the story of a king and his citizens. He says, let me tell you what I'm doing is about. You can go to the next slide. He says, what's going to happen in my life is like a certain nobleman who went to a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called 10 of his servants and delivered to them 10 minas, his money, 10, and said to them, do business until I come. I'm going to leave and I'm going to come back and see how you ran the business. But his citizens hated him. What a weird story about a guy who's got citizens of his own kingdom and they hate him. So they sent a delegation after him and saying, no king, no nobleman, we will not have you reign over us. And Jesus says, that's kind of what I'm going to be like. I am the Messiah. I'm the predicted one. I fulfill all these promises. I've come to my own people, my own citizens, and they're going to reject me. They do not want me and my way of life to reign over them. Then he goes on later and says, in fact, I'm going to be killed, be in the grave for 3 days, and raise myself from the dead. The disciples are like, what does he mean by that? Well, it turns out he meant he was going to die and be in the grave for 3 days and raised from the dead. But they said, no mindset to make up this story. He just keeps claiming, I've come to be your king and your father, to reign over you with my love. But you're going to have this tendency to say, I don't want your love. I don't want your administration. I don't want your love to reign over me. Huh. So what we find is we have consistent story over hundreds of years, even thousands of years. We have no good agenda for lying on this story. We have facts that only a spectator living in that time and that place would know, and we have evidence to corroborate his predictions of his own death and resurrection, and these kind of weird hidden coincidences that only make sense of people who are writing during the first century to know things that only somebody would know about the weather, about the time period, about what happens in that spot. So let's put it all together. Throughout the series, we've tried to put a variety together, but let's start with, we've got this detective who's an atheist. He has no good reason. It's not like his book sold that well. You've probably never heard him before the series. He investigated the truth, and he says as a detective, who's known on Dateline and other places, the facts led him to Jesus being who he says is historically. Then we've got evidences from these four biographies cited by a book called Hidden, another one called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, that these are actually historically reliable documents that can be verified even before you trust in them. We have things that the Bible claims, leaders that existed, and we found evidence in the archaeological record to prove that this really happened. We have things they claimed about crucifixion, how it happened, where the nails went, that we actually have records of that we can see and we can look at. Each one of these builds a preponderance of a case that these are eyewitnesses and this is true, and that maybe the God of the universe, he wants to be involved in your life. What if it's true? Wouldn't you want it to be true that the God of the universe came to earth and despite you rejecting him in many ways initially, if not for a long time, he was willing to die for you and continue to show you a better way to live? Wouldn't you at least want that to be true? I know I would. Now back to our case. How did Jim Wallace reopen this case? How did he determine that this was not a real eyewitness account so he could eventually find and prosecute the real murderer? Well, number one, he reopened the case his dad had kept open despite having a confession. And he hoped that new DNA and new tech would help bring some validation to whether or not this was true. As he read through his dad's notes of all the investigation he did on this guy who confessed, because he had 1,000 pages worth of manuscripts, he started finding little bitty inconsistencies every time he told the story. Now, his dad had noted it, and his dad even made some notes in the edge, just as an observant homicide detective. This guy seems to want attention. This guy seems too eager for this confession. Next. He started noticing a few things. Yes, the suspect was thriving on the attention, but the story changed even more, not subtly, but in major ways each time he told it. He was eager, not really broken, not genuine repentance or brokenness the way you might see in somebody who was really trying to fess up. Then lastly, the DNA that they found, because there was new tech and new science, did not match, not one piece of the DNA of this guy who confessed in any way was found at the scene. In fact, someone else's DNA was found. Therefore, they determined that despite his confession, he didn't have means and he didn't have opportunity to do it. So, They realized he had fabricated the entire story just because he wanted attention. So they reopened the case, dismissed him as an eyewitness, and eventually found the killer to this little girl. Using the same type of logic, the same type of questions that you and I might use to look at a historical document as well. Now, maybe you like history. In the last 5 weeks, you said, I've loved this stuff. Maybe you're like, I hate history. I've hated this stuff. Good news, we're going to move on to something new next week if you hated it. Bad news, if you love it, we're moving on to something different next week. But I want to encourage you, we've used the Who music in this series. I want to encourage you to quote Peter Thompson, Townsend rather, let his love open the door. And then, as he said here in that parable, let his love reign over you. If he's a king, he comes with a kingdom, and that comes with ways to live that will help you rescue yourself from worry or doubt, ways to treat people, ways to overcome guilt, ways to defeat death. He comes with a full administration. He wants to reign over you. And maybe in this series, you've never had your door open to the possibility. Christians have done such a bad job of displaying Christianity. You're like, I don't have anything to do with it. But maybe you met somebody, a neighbor, a friend, who like, that one seems genuine. They're not all self-righteous. Oh, I like the humility I see in that marriage, and you're a Christian. Just let the door open to be a little open-minded, and maybe pick up one of the books I talked about. We'd love to get in a group with you or just have a place to ask your questions. Just to help you, let the door open to the possibility this might be true. Or maybe over the case, the last 5 weeks you said, man, I had no idea this evidence was there. I had no idea so many facts. I'm probably not going to look into it, honestly, but you've convinced me that this is credible. I feel like I've done some verifying, and now I'm ready to do some trusting. If there's a God who came from heaven to earth to die for me, and that kind of love, the kind of love that loves your enemies is possible, that kind of compassion, that kind of strength, that kind of courage, I want some of that in my life. Then maybe today's the day. You say, God, let your love open the door and let your love reign in me. But if you're not into history, one of the most powerful evidences that this is true is people you know in our community whose lives are changing because of this message. It's far better than history, actually. I had a guy this week came up to me and says, hey, I was talking to somebody, and they asked me where I go to church. I said, I go to church at Horizon. They said, Horizon, we go to that church. And this person said, oh my goodness, I can't tell you how the messages and the getting into the Bible for the first time, it has changed our lives. And they're telling this story. I said, that's awesome. And then they said, we really love it when that bald guy preaches. I assume they're talking about Ryan Ventura, is what I assumed. Couldn't have been me. I kid you not, I had one at the end of last service. There is not a week goes by that I don't have two or three people I've never talked to before on this topic who come up and talk about how living out this life of Jesus is making marriages better, reconciling with kids, bringing forgiveness, bringing restoration. This stuff works. So if you don't care about all the history, that's fine. Look at how it works in the people around you. In fact, with that, I want you to hear a story of Matt Worth. Maybe you know Matt. He's a lawyer here in our area. He began his story of letting God's love open the door initially to now reign over him. And look at how it's changed his life. Maybe you want to ask today for God's love to reign over you. Let's watch.
In 2016, 10 years ago, here, my wife and I had recently found this church, recently started attending this church with our baby daughter, our first child. As time went on, we heard Chad or probably Chad talk about, child dedication. And again, we not really understanding child dedication, but knowing that this is what you do in this church with your children, if you're a believer, we kind of said, okay, well, we're gonna participate in child dedication. And in November of 2016, my wife and I, we dedicated our daughter Addison to following Christ. And very soon thereafter, I think, even that day or the reception of the child dedication, I met John Kirby. And I approached John and I basically said, look, John, I don't know what to believe. I don't know if I believe in anything. I've never read the Bible. I've never really gotten into the source document itself. But I you know, I've just now dedicated my child to doing this thing. I probably ought to go ahead and see what it says. At that same time, I'd been a lawyer for 5.5 years or so. I'd been working my butt off to become a partner at my law firm for those 5.5 years. In 2019, when my son was born, I had just made partner at my law firm. We threw a party and there was this great excitement and I had achieved this 5.5 year tireless goal. And I woke up the next day or the day after and I realized that joy had all but gone. It was fleeting and there wasn't really anything sustaining about that achievement that stayed with me for, you know, even a couple days. At that point in time, I realized that there has to be more. There has to be something else that I'm here for. I had a desire to take that next step of obedience. I had heard Drew or Chad, talking about the importance of being in a Bible study, being in a group of guys or gals that meets together regularly to read the Word. I didn't really know where to start with that, but I kind of noticed I have all these friends of mine that I play golf with that also attend here at Horizon. We all have kids around the same ages. We all, go to our kids' sports together. We're in social settings together. I thought, well, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if I'm going to be laughed at. I don't know if I'm going to be, embarrassed by it. But I think that this is a perfectly good group of guys to get together and see if they want to study the Bible together. I called John. I said, John, I think I'd like to start my own Bible study group. There's this group of guys that I know real well from other places. We also attend together at Horizon. I don't know how to ask. I don't know how to get it started, but I'd like to start a Bible study. Can you help me figure out how to do that? And of course, John being John, he leaped at the idea of starting another Bible study. And fast forward a year from then until now, we've got an awesome growing group of men who get together every Wednesday morning at 7 a.m., read the Word together. I wish that I wouldn't have waited 9 years to join a group, to form a group, to be in a group. There's something different that happens when you're in a small group setting with people who are, hungry, questioning, grappling with, learning. There's something magical that happens when you're in a group where the understanding that you take away from whatever it is that you're studying that day can't really be achieved in the same manner or the same level by yourself. My group of guys personally, I can say, have lifted me up. They've held me accountable. The relationships that you will form in a small group Bible study and the understanding of God's Word that you will gain from being in Bible study is, it's changed my life.